Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And there's a lot to go through. So this is our presidential or actually, it's our special episodes covering our presidential election campaign. And so every Monday, we cover what I believe America needs and what we really deserve in our politics. I mean, we deserve honesty in our politics. We deserve a leader that is grounded. I'm not just grounded, is the epitome of leading on the Constitution. I mean, our president should be beyond reproach when it comes to the Constitution. You know, even though George Washington may not have understood the Constitution and relied heavily upon the father of the Constitution, James Madison, he did have, you know, I'll just say some leniency towards some certain things, like when it came down to the Assumption Act, when it came down to some of the things that he ended up doing, he actually, you know, took a consensus. He actually looked at, you know, because some things he actually held back on. He didn't want to pass some laws until, you know, he got the acquiescence or, you know, went out and kind of spoke to the people. And I'm not talking about the common man, but he traveled to other states and got their sentiments on things and said, okay, you know, all right, we'll pass that. Or, you know, since everybody's in favor of that, that's what we'll do. And so even though the bill was just kind of sitting there waiting for him to do something on. So anyway, even though the Constitution says that if a bill is not signed, they didn't, back in those days, you know, go through breakneck speeds. And they had a lot of respect for Washington, so they gave him latitude. The interesting thing that most people don't know is James Madison wrote, you know, almost 100% of the correspondence between Congress and the president, almost 100% of it, you know, in the very first couple of years. Because Washington, you know, he's a busy man, I'm sure, but he just didn't have the confidence. As a matter of fact, his farewell address that he signed his name to, the majority of that farewell address was written by James Madison. Maybe parts of it that he brought in and incorporated. And I can tell you that because I can see Madison's voice, or I can clearly recognize Madison's voice in that document. But, you know, I can easily go down, all, you know, when I dive into this history, I can go into the rat holes of details and those types of things. But I don't want to do that. And so what I do want to do is I want to get back into this plan of what we need to do as a nation. And I've prepared quite a bit. I think I've got enough. And this is actually, as I'm doing this, I'm creating an outline. And so once I'm all done with all of this, I plan on posting this so that you can see, you know, in like a PowerPoint bullet format, you know, everything that I've said and everything that I've basically asserted that the president could actually do. You got to understand, the president, you know, isn't the king, but he can lead. And he can lead on the Constitution, and he actually can go down to the states. He can go to the counties and make recommendations and say, what do you need from me to help you do these things? Because, see, one of the things I learned a long time ago is that the most effective leaders actually delegate, or they actually empower the leaders underneath them so that they can do what they need to do. And more importantly, not only empower them, but as a key leader, as the president, I would do everything I can. And any good president should do everything possible in moving the obstacles and making sure that they have what they need to be successful, or better yet, or more specifically, that none of the obstacles that they're dealing with would be coming from the federal government. And as a matter of fact, the president has that power. It is clear. He has that power. Now, you know, I've really thought a lot about, you know, the magnitude of corruption that our government has. And I've even thought about how corrupt our military has become. And my question is, it used to be said that the Marine Corps was the faithful service that would actually arise to the occasion. And looking at how our military has been debased and has become the social experiment for this debauchery of gender reassignment and, you know, this again, this petri dish of social engineering. You know, when you look historically, when Rome did these types of things, or when great empires and nations did these types of things, this is when the military can no longer defend itself. Now, we're talking about the military, you know, currently, as we're going through what we need to do to, you know, engage with engage with the changes or the reconstruction of our strategic defenses, right? I mean, that's essentially what I was covering when we went away last Monday. I just want you to understand that there are some real difficulties in covering the details of a presidential plan to lead the efforts of Republic Review and restoring our constitutional republic due to the intricacies of the functions of government. You know, because as you go down and you deal with one thing, there are other things that may be involved with that. You know, like the judiciary, like the legislative and so forth, because we actually have the way they have mucked with government. They have made it so that the judiciary is too involved in everything we're doing. And they're dictating everything almost, instead of our legislators staying within the limitations of the Constitution and just enforcing the law. So I can't emphasize enough that, you know, I appreciate the feedback that I'm getting, and I hope that you understand the difficulty in really trying to lay this out, map this out, so that I don't have to do a lot of go-backs. So it takes time for me to sit down and kind of lay this out as I'm looking at the Constitution and what the president needs to do so that you, the states, you, the people, can get your counties and your states back in line with the Constitution so that you can force the federal government into compliance. Imagine that, a servant, a president of the United States, allowing and enabling the people and the counties and the states to basically disassemble the Leviathan that has been created over the past couple centuries. Imagine that. Imagine having a president that would actually do that. I mean, it is antithetical to an organism when it grows to a point of obtaining more and more power to where it becomes tyrannical. It is hard to even fathom how, you know, that you could have a leader of that organism actually chopping off limbs and chopping off, you know, parts of it that have no constitutional presence, no attachment to the Constitution. Therefore, it must be chopped off. It has no place in government. And it's all happened. Again, Madison, in writing, you know, the farewell address, really said it best, that with the most noble intent, a usurpation with the best intent is the common destruction of a nation. That's what we're looking at. I mean, why would we think anything differently? And they're only proving that point. I mean, look at where we are, folks. We are in such a flux. There are so many changes our government is preparing everything it needs to do to get away from the Constitution. I've been telling you that there has been a war that they've been fighting against you and the states. And their end goal is to sever and to obtain full sovereignty over all things. In other words, instead of you having your rights, and these fools, these idiots that have gone into this what they call the sovereign citizen movement, it is the sovereign inhabitant and will soon be the slaves or the executed. Because they have no ability. What they have done is they've removed themselves from being able to actually help. And, you know, anybody that has any cognizance understands that. These fools that are lying to you, telling you that the 14th Amendment subjugated you and made you chattel, basically a slave to the state, is lying. And so here's my challenge to anyone that says they can prove this. Go through the 263 pages and actually times that by three, because that's the reality. Each page of the congressional record is three pages, three normal pages. So therefore, go through the 1,000 pages of the congressional record where they debated the constitutional amendment, the 14th Amendment. And you prove to me that there was any language, any assertion that the people would become chattel. They were very clear when they discussed, as a matter of fact, these arguments were very, very clear that the states were the problems and that the privileges and immunities that the states were actually violating were no longer going to be able to violate. These idiots are using lies, deceit, and fear-mongering. And I guess you can't avoid fear-mongering because everybody can see, you know, why there is a good reason to be fearful of such a evil, destructive, and I'll just say corrupt government that we have today. But all things being equal, let me just dive into, because I've got a little less than 12 minutes left to get into the presidential campaign. So let me also say this. If you subscribe to Monix, if you go in and subscribe to our YouTube channel and go in and make your claim, one of the things I had found out, and so there's only a one-time, just so you understand this, there's only a one-time commission for the referral that you get. And so that's nice. It's nice that you get a referral. So you'll get, you know, whoever you bring in, each of those people that you bring in, you'll get a one-time commission. Because I thought about it, so I asked Nav, I said, so every time a person buys more and buys more, what? Because there's this possibility that somebody can go in and actually do trading. In other words, buying and selling. And when they buy and sell, then, you know, they can make some money and they walk away with a little bit of money. And that's how you can play the commodities. Well, Monix will actually allow you to do that as well. And so when you do that, if you buy, they still have limits of what you can buy. So it's either, you know, this much or that much. And bottom line, I'm recommending Monix not for buying and selling, but for buying and holding, for you to actually hold your silver, for you to actually hold your gold. Now, there are many ways to be able to hide your treasure in your castle, many ways. And so, I mean, shoot, all you got to do is just look online and you'll find all sorts of great ways to doing that. And, you know, sometimes Murphy doors, sometimes, you know, Murphy floors, you know, things that look like, and, you know, it's actually hiding something. But more importantly, what I recommend, you know, to be honest with you, is to utilize your full property. I get it. If you live in a condo and you don't have any yard, then you're going to have a hard time holding on to gold. And so what do you do if you have to bug out? I mean, what do you, you know, how are you, you need to have at least a small repository. Now, when I talk about a small repository, I'm not talking about, you know, a big, huge cache where, you know, you've got a chest full of gold that you can't even lift, or a chest full of, you know, precious metals that you can't even lift. Folks, you don't need that much gold and silver. If you are looking to, you know, preserve a lot of wealth, then you need to look at, you know, a repository or a place where you can actually save that. And possibly when you look at the, I forget what it's called. I'll have to come over here and look at the Take Action page, because I have it right there on the Take Action page. And is the United Precious Metals Association. That might be a better place for the holding of your gold. If you're looking to actually have gold and you're just going to let it sit there, then this may be a better suggestion for you. Buy from Monex and then have it deposited there. So in other words, you buy it and have them ship it. And as I understand it, I think Monex actually ships a lot of their stuff out of Utah. At least the last shipment I got came from Utah. My first shipment came from Irvine, California. So I have no idea, you know, where the shipment will come from, but you can always have that shipment going straight into your account. It'll be like, it's kind of like a courier. It's dropped off and it will go straight into your account. I'm sure you can set it all up so that that can all be done. And that way, instead of having, you know, any gold in your hand, you would actually have a card that you would possess, or I don't know, there may be other mechanisms that you just kind of let it sit dormant. And then you, if you need to take receipt of it, I don't know, maybe you can even go pick it up. You just fly out there, drive out there, whatever, and just pick it up. But anyway, let me move on, because this is, you know, when it comes to you, your treasure, it's a very personal plan. I'm only giving you a recommendation of who I have found who actually beats the prices. And, you know, I do know that you'll find on Yelp and others, there are people that complain about Monex. Now, Monex may not be, I have no complaints. They've been awesome when I've purchased and taken receipt of. And I believe the complaints out online are when people take the other services, like when they have Monex hold on to or what have you. Now, I actually bought silver for them to hold, because a long time ago they had this policy that if you bought it to hold, and in other words, you paid to for them to store it, and it cost maybe less than $10 or whatever whatever I was paying for what I had, it didn't cost much, and I just had them hold on to it, and they held on to it for a month. It was cheaper for them to, you know, to sell it to me, to hold on to it, and then ship it to me than it was, because if I had a direct shipment, I paid more money. And so, you know, obviously, who isn't going to try to game to get the best price? And so what they did was, I think they closed that loop, or they said, okay, well, everybody's taking advantage of it, so we'll just do it this way. But anyway, let me move on to the curriculum of the day. Now, what we left off with was sunsetting. So again, this is all about reconfiguring the Department of Defense to align with the Constitution and get our national security back aligned with the militia for the homeland security of America. So sunset the active departments of Space, Army, the Air Force, and the Coast Guard from the Department of Transportation, and move all forces that serve strategic missions, strategic nature, under the Department of the Navy. In other words, anything that is dealing with an external threat, you know, a threat by air, a threat from space, a threat from, you know, and when I say from space, a lot of these intercontinental ballistic missiles are threats from space. And we also know that China is looking to militarize the moon. Everything that they do is with a military concept, just to be clear. So we want to make sure that we have all forces, or I should say all roles, responsibilities of a strategic nature moved under the Department of the Navy, where it actually belongs in the Constitution. And therefore, all projection of force is done by the Navy and the Marine Corps. So moving those elements from the Army, moving those elements from the National Guard, or I should say the National Guard, the National Air, and the Air Force, all of these things under the Navy and Marine Corps. And so retiring the departments, all of these departments, just look at it this way, folks. Go count how many people are in the headquarters, Marine Corps headquarters, Navy, and then go look at how many people are employed in the, this is like the HR administration of each of the departments. Now, look at the Joint Chiefs of Staff. See, the Joint Chiefs of Staff currently is the principal commandant, the leaders of each of these departments. Well, you don't have to, get rid of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Basically, you'd have these strategic missions, right? So you'd have a strategic mission that you would make sure that your aviation, the leader of aviation. So you'd move over these roles, but you wouldn't have redundancy anymore because the Navy already has probably a commanding general at the headquarters that is, overseeing the strategic air development, all of that. And this is the same thing with using the Marine Corps for the ground ground warfare tactics, which includes air, Navy, and that type of stuff. So it doesn't mean that you would actually whittle down the Joint Chiefs of Staff to just two seats with the Navy and the Marine Corps sitting there. You would actually make sure that the operative leaders, now DON, the Department of the Navy's top general, or admiral, I should say, would no longer, be the Joint Chief, but it would be the tactical the strategic leaders that would actually be sitting at the Chiefs of Staff. Now, whether the Admiral would be considered the Joint Chief or what have you, but one other part of this would be the Army's, strategic management. Because, see, if we're not under attack, then we have this Department of Army. So why do we have a Department of Homeland Security? That's technically the Army. The Department of Homeland Security is doing things that the federal government doesn't even have the authority to do, in enforcing and policing. And the reason why we have all of these problems and the complexity is because our own government has actually gone so far rogue. We have way too many open pores where our government is allowed, specific things to actually occur and specific actions and entities to be on U.S. soil. This is because we have lost sight of what we are supposed to be focused on in protecting our sovereignty. And this is what happens when you actually get leaders of this nation for over a century enamored with the idea of seeking global control. In other words, this globalist concept that began in the early 1900s, this was the doom of our national sovereignty and our national security when they actually said, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to allow this to happen. So we'll get to the foreign affairs like dismantling the UN and all of that. But let me just keep moving on here. So we're going to realign the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, which is NASA, to focus strictly on national defense and research and abolish any and all forms of involvement or analysis in progressive demagoguery. In other words, they're not to be involved in concepts or to conserve or converse, research, or do anything regarding climate change. The federal government, you folks, you want the federal government to do that? You're a fool. If you want the states to do that, then that would be the smart thing, to let the states monitor that and let them make the decisions that would be meeting their strategic needs, because the federal government is focused on military and national defense and protecting sovereignty. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
You know, as a matter of fact, I think that we really need to look at the responsibility and liability, right? I mean, so every state has this law in their constitution that defined, most all the states, folks, believe it or not, got it right when it comes down to the freedom of the press and freedom of speech, because they liken them the same and they look at it as an individual right, not as a platform right. In other words, we'll get into this a little bit later, you know, in a different context. But we will find that there has to be liability for every individual. And we have to have a higher standard of liability for every public servant. So as the president, I'm just going off on this limb here, just for so you to make a mental note, and it's not going to be in my notes here because it just came up to me, and hopefully I'll remember to add this. And please, by all means, send me feedback to make sure I add this. But I believe that we need to inspire Congress, or actually the states. We need the states to actually add into the Bill of Rights a dog ear, or actually we want to have them create an amendment, maybe to the second, the First Amendment, to amend it to include, after the right of petition for the redress of grievances, include that any and all public servants who use demagoguery without any evidence to create fear-mongering, to invoke, you know, fear and panic, will be held fully liable. And what this means, folks, because what they're doing, look at what Gore did. Gore lied, and we all know he lied because there was no evidence that proved what he was saying. There's no evidence that he could say that the earth was sick. There's no evidence whatsoever. There's evidence that the world is changing, and there's evidence that there may be a need to look at the world and the climate. However, it is not the role of the federal government to do that. If the states want to do that, because that's a domestic concern, not a national threat concern, then so be it. Let the states do that. But at the federal government, because you got to remember, the Bill of Rights was designed to constrain the federal government in politics. And I think you do the same thing. It would be wise. It actually, once you've applied it to the First Amendment, it does get retroactively applied to the states because of the 14th Amendment. So in other words, all politicians should be held criminally liable for any form of demagoguery. In other words, they get away with using the freedom of speech without directing scientific context, actually without looking at empirical data and proving In other words, it's one thing if somebody really gets up and says, I'm looking at the analysis of all of this and I have a hypothesis that this is what may happen, instead of trying to inject these ambiguous, you know, theories and inject ambiguous data and actually twisting data. You know, folks, the fact that they have been modifying and changing the data for years, there needs to be a liability for this. And every scientist and everybody that's all colluded and worked together, they need to answer. They need to be answering for what they have done. And this is why we need to actually make that law. One of the reasons why I love Deuteronomy is because I love the one, it's just basically a no-nonsense type of law that anybody that creates a false accusation and, you know, let it be proven whether the accusation be true. And if that person that made that accusation cannot prove, or if falls short of actually proving it and comes to find out it, you know, it was a fallacious accusation, then let that person who brings forth, this will stop these women, these men, anybody who's claiming, you know, abuse, you know, those types of things, because let them suffer the penalty of the crime that they claimed that the other person had committed. Because, folks, if you want to rid yourself of, you know, this duplicity of criminal activity, then we need to start injecting some of these laws. It's only fair, you know, that people that want to make false accusations actually suffer in basically serving the time for the crime that they tried to invoke upon somebody else. So I'm sorry. Let me get back onto track, because there's two things that I just threw at you. Okay, those are two amendments that I think the states really need to consider as a part of the Bill of Rights. So anyway, pushing the Army structure back into the state militia and downsizing the Department of the Army into an office under the Navy, much like the Marine Corps, focusing funding on the states in organizing, equipping, and disciplining the militia. Now, just remember the old saying, you get, you know, be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it, right? Okay, so what has been the militia? Because, you know, when we really think about it, everybody has this obligation. Now, all of these people that have been out in these militias and, you know, they've made their life out of the militia movement, well, the last, I think some in some of these cases, the last thing that these people really wanted was a full-blown, you know, national militia. I don't think that, I think that they may have wanted to serve, but this was, you know, their way of feeling like guts and glory. I don't know. But I don't believe they all really have been, because I've actually worked with some of these folks, and it seems like they're really not interested in getting involved in really solving the problem. They're just more interested in going out on the weekends and having fun and playing drills and those types of things, which, you know, when you do it every day of the week and you're on deployment all the time, you know, those in the military really get tired of doing that. Believe you me, after 20 years, I'm happy not to don that uniform anymore. I've done it enough. And so I understand the national need for it. And I understand that, you know, we need to be able to, you know, serve in some capacity, because our liberty depends on it. Those people who choose not to serve, those people who choose not to get involved, and as a matter of fact, those people who want to be so conscientious as an objector, you know, like these sovereign citizens, they want to be conscientious objectors to, you know, our rights and our liberties, then, because we've talked about it, you know, the government doesn't even touch our rights, But the Constitution was not, was not designed in any way to actually establish the inalienable rights. That's between a person and God. What they did was they created privileges and immunities to ensure that the government would not be able to touch those things. Because clearly, you know, they created these constraints, as well as they, more importantly, they created the enumerations of powers. So when these nationalists make this comment, they can arbitrarily take away your rights. Hold on here. Where is that enumerated? They can only do those things enumerated. These fools are getting people to believe that they can actually do those things. Yeah, they're doing those things unconstitutionally. And that's what their problem is. They really believe that these are legitimate things that they're doing, and they're not. Anyway, I just get infuriated, and it's just very frustrating to see how many people, because I've met people that I've known that have been sucked into this. And as a matter of fact, there are families that are they're being destroyed because of this. Folks, you need to really back out and really say, well, you know, what does Christ want us to do? Does he want us to protect liberty, or does he want to abandon the one document he gave us that would do that? Seriously. Anybody that claims that that Constitution is not of Christ and of God, that he didn't foreordain that like the framers had told us, then, you know, I think that you need to have a serious conversation, and you need to really say, make sure you understand what you're saying, because you're going to abandon your citizenship for something that is not of God. It is an anarchy thing. There's nothing out there. Once you've abandoned your citizenship under this Constitution, you become a subject to something else, or even worse, you become a subject to nothing. In other words, anarchy. You know, we are all subjects of God, regardless of what nation we are a part of. In China, every person is a subject to God, and every knee will bow. And no sovereign or nationalist can tell you otherwise. You may have differences in government, but when it comes down to people, we all have our inalienable rights. And we all have to make those choices. And those who make the choice to abandon us in this time of need and be that selfish so that they don't have to pay taxes, shame on them. Shame on them. Okay, so one of the things that we need to do is we're reconfiguring this Department of Defense to align with the Constitution. The federal government, as the president, we need to, and I will actually direct Congress to cease and desist, you know, any involvement in education other than providing the necessary standards and the disciplines and everything else regarding the militia, and fund those needs of equipping and training every person from K to 12 in understanding their responsibility as a citizen in education to ensure all children are properly educated and prepared and ready to serve the Constitution if necessary. Funding the training for K-12 with the fundamentals to good physical and mental health, firearms fundamentals, firearm safety, basic and advanced marksmanship, militia tactics, militia structure, militia standards, militia missions and interoperability, and their responsibility in executing the laws of the Union, suppressing insurrections, and repelling invasions. And we want to carry this even further. As a matter of fact, I'll get into it now, but I'm going to repeat this down the road as I'm diving into the states and counties, that we need to make sure that the militia is basically engulfing, not just executing the laws of the Union, but executing the laws of the states and the laws of the county. because if we're really looking at what the concept behind this Constitution is, it is a self-government. The whole concept is that we're supposed to be enforcing all of our laws. So as the president, I would actually make a declaration, you know, that the Dick Act was unconstitutional, and it may have been signed, but it will no longer be regarded as constitutional law. That, you know, I believe it was Teddy Roosevelt that passed it, or that signed it, maybe. I'm pretty sure it was. But the subsequent Militia Acts and the Dick Act were unconstitutionally done to transform the state's militia into the National Guard and eventually the National Air Guard, and take the original constitutional framework apportioned to the counties away and basically left it at the state level, so that the counties could be neglected. And that's why many counties have no true defense. And if you look, go look along the northern border and find out how many counties actually are along that northern border and how many counties have an adequate militia for actually, you know, protecting that border. There should be at least an adequate apportionment for the militia for that, for the border, so that they should have an inordinate amount. And we'll get into the militia, what active militia, what's inactive, ready reserves, and so forth, because that's got to be a part of this design. I mean, let's learn from these, I'll just say, tyrants who, you know, these warmongers who have created, you know, quite an elaborate national system. And let's look at utilizing some of those lessons learned down in the states and in the counties. So we need to provide funding for an expanse of the militia into an active county force and into a large inactive county force with a ready reserve on call. In other words, it's like an on call. So in other words, the sheriff is going to basically have access to two groups. He's going to have access to the militia that's active. That is those who are actually, you know, on a full-time basis that are, in other words, they're deputies of the sheriff. And so here's the question. Well, actually, we'll get into that later. And then the ready reserve are those who would be necessary to actually support the sheriff, you know, on a dime, where he can actually make a phone call and activate these people. Because bottom line, when you have the ability to do this, what you're talking about is the sheriff has the ability to spend money. Because when you're putting people in service, they can get compensated. So the county commissioners need to actually be wise and in controlling and keeping it so that there's not too many people employed, that the appropriate amount of people are employed in dealing with the law. But more importantly, as we really start looking at every person being able to enforce the laws of the state, the laws of the county, and the laws of the union, then we actually look at the ready reserve of having a large ready reserve that you don't necessarily need to call them all up, but you want to have a large enough ready reserve so that even though that person may not be on active, you know, is not getting compensated, they actually have the ability to step in and then be compensated for stepping in. In other words, if there's a crime in commission and there is no sheriff around at the time, active militia sheriff, and you are a ready reserve and you're carrying your TO weapon, all, as a matter of fact, all members of the militia need to be carrying their TO weapon, active, inactive, or what have you. And there should be the inactive reserve would be only those people that would not be carrying their TO weapon. In other words, they're really on the civilian side. In other words, the inactive, the ready reserve of the inactive are those people who have been released and no longer, not that they don't have a gun, but no longer required to carry a gun. every person that is a part of the inactive reserve, the ready reserve, and the active militia. Those three groups are all required to carry their weapon. So in other words, we're actually going to be seeing guns even more frequent, and everywhere we go, everybody should be seeing guns. Now, the question is, who's going to be brave enough when we actually have everybody understanding their duty and responsibility of protecting life and property, and in understanding that, you know, they have a responsibility to enforce the law? If they're the customers of a store, a grocery store, a convenience store, or, you know, they're a customer in a bank, and somebody thinks that they want to steal property from somebody else, then everybody that, and because most of the people will be carrying a gun. There's only going to be those people in the county group that would, you know, like the older people, you know, the less, you know, active and so forth. But 9 times out of 10, do you fear when an old person comes into the room, a gray hair, right? Are you afraid of that person as a threat? 9 times out of 10, no. Now, doesn't mean that an old person can't carry their gun. They're just not required to. But they're not the threat anymore. The threat are those who, you know, are filled with piss and vim, and, you know, they just, you know, they think they're invincible, and they, you know, they want to get rich quick, that type of thing. And that's usually done with somebody that's lacking wisdom and maturity. And so 9 times out of 10, it doesn't matter what culture you're looking at. Every culture, the older people are far more, and the word is mellow. As a matter of fact, I remember listening to LaRosa, I believe it was a LaRosa speech, where this guy talked about, you know, going after the old and the feeble, you know, of the white community, because, you know, they can't really defend themselves well. Now, I think many people have learned and have seen viral videos out there that have actually proven otherwise, that, you know, be forewarned that, you know, grandpa, you know, may pack a punch, because I've seen plenty of times where, you know, these kids think that they're tough enough to take on grandpa, and they realize that they've, you know, in the ensuing butt whooping that they get, that, you know, they shouldn't take grandpas and grandmas for granted. And so I think anybody that's raised a son has realized that there's that point in time where the son finally, you know, gets to feel like, you know, he can take dad on. And hopefully that never happens. But 9 times out of 10, when a son does that, you know, if the dad is properly, you know, doing what a dad should be doing, then the dad should still be able, you know, to subdue the son and say, why are you doing this? Because, one, he has the wisdom, but he should still also have the strength and ability. Folks, we all need to understand what our, you know, as we advance in our age of, you know, the stages of life, we need to get away from being the, you know, the lazy society, and, you know, and fulfill our obligations of being able to do what is necessary at those given points in time. But anyway, I hope you kind of understand that the county militia structure, pretty much everybody in the county, you know, is already registered as a part of, and you're just basically filling a feature where, you know, only of, you know, a small percentage, probably not even 1%, right? If you have 100,000 people in your county, 1% would be 1,000, right? And so if, you know, 1,000 deputies to enforce the law, no, we could really scale that back. And let's look at dividing that 1,000 down to, you know, and when we talk about militia, we're actually talking about people that are enforcing. Now, we actually should be looking at how the county government, and see, the sheriff, you know, everybody loves to have their own little fiefdoms. And what we need to do at the county level is we need to cut costs. And so we can't allow the sheriff to create this huge empire of, you know, all of these other things. And as a matter of fact, I can tell you that there are way too many sheriffs today running intelligence operations and those types of things when they should not be doing that. They should not be violating our constitutional rights. And it's the same thing with, you know, police enforcement and so forth. But we're going to get into the county configurations a little bit more as we progress. But due to, you know, this, you know, these forces that I'm talking about, we need to look at integrating the county militia rotations from the inactive into the active and ready reserve militia forces for both strategic and local law enforcement cognizance by the county legislatures under the control of the sheriff. So in other words, the county commissioners and or technically, we're going to get to this, the county executive should actually have the, you know, the cognizance over, you know, all of the other forces that are not employed by the sheriff. And he should be the one that would actually, you know, authorize, not the sheriff. The sheriff, it's just a one-person call to say, hey, you know, governor, because whatever you want to call your executive of your county, I'm okay with calling him governor. If you want to call him something different, baron, captain, you know, some of those things have different connotations, but come up with what you call the executive of your county. And the executive, because we need to maintain, I just want to keep on, I'm going to say this a lot, we need to maintain a civilian authority over the force of, or over lethal force. In other words, over deadly force. When deadly force can ever in any time be applied, we need to ensure that a civilian command is always overseen to ensure that one, because we do not want to lose sight of the responsibility of protecting life. And we need to innovate laws. I mean, we need to come up with ways that we can actually, you know, seize control of somebody with, you know, incapacitate them without causing them harm. And I'm not convinced that, you know, tasers and those types of things would possibly be the right way, because we've actually seen that kill people. So there's got to be a better way. And, you know, drugs and the reactions and those types of things, there's got to be a better way. And I know there is, but it's just a matter of really looking, you know, because the reason why nobody does this is because there's very little money in it. There's money in killing and doing damage and destroying things. Boy, that's where everybody wants to spend the money. Anyway. And I think I mentioned a long, long time ago that I actually provided a plan of how to actually come in and seize control during an event of mass crime, you know, like an insurrection, like a riot. And we've actually seen these things. And there's no doubt in my mind, the executives that I spoke to at BAE Systems, you know, when they saw this crap happening, they probably said, you know, GR had told us about this. And, you know, because I presented to them a plan in 2013 of a surefire way of being able to completely suppress, you know, these types of insurrections and how to do that. And, you know, it would not be as costly. But bottom line, this is how we can actually go down the path of protecting life and making sure that everybody serves time. I'm telling you, there's going to be a short transition between unlawfulness to civility as we transition back onto the Constitution. But we will have unlawfulness. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution?
To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.